This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 30th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 349, and happy Canada Day to Canadian listeners and Independence Day to American listeners. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and John Rustad's Conservatives have narrowed the gap, but David Eby's NDP is still poised to win the October provincial election. What are the issues? What are the trends? You've come to the right place. Research Co's Mario Canseco joins me to look at his latest poll on BC politics with 16 weeks until Election Day. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Mario Canseco, the president of Research Co., who has a new poll on British Columbia politics with the provincial election approaching on October 19th, just 16 weeks away. The headline on this is BC NDP lead narrows as British Columbians ponder choices. The second place Conservatives have narrowed the gap with the first place NDP. The third place Greens are up. BC United is in fourth. Yes, the former BC Liberals are not even on the podium right now. The NDP leads in Metro Vancouver, Vancouver Island, and Southern BC, which probably would be enough to keep it in power. The Conservatives lead in the Fraser Valley and Northern BC. Mario, what are the takeaways from your poll for each party and each leader?
Well, starting from the bottom up, a very complicated situation for BC United. They're only supported by 11% of decided voters. The retention rate from 2020 is abysmal. Usually you want to be at around the 60 or 70% mark when it comes to people who voted for you in the last election. They're only holding on to 29% of those who voted for Andrew Wilkinson and the BC Liberals in the 2020 election. So definitely not a lot of traction right now for BC United. The Greens had a good month. They were up 3 points. They're starting to get closer to the level of support that they had in the island back in 2020, nowhere near the level they had in 2017, but just growing a little bit and, you know, connecting on some other parts of the province. But, you know, without one of their MLAs running for office, it certainly signifies a very complicated battle, especially when it comes to recruiting candidates. For the Conservatives, it's a good poll. You know, they're 7 points behind the NDP. Essentially, the province coming back to the way in which all the elections in this century have been. A very dominant center-left party, sometimes in government, sometimes not. Then a very dominant center-right party. But most people a year ago expected BC United to be that option. And now it's the BC Conservatives. Now ahead in the Fraser Valley and in northern British Columbia, this definitely calls into question whether some of those incumbents from BC United are going to be able to hold on to their seats when you have a significant level of support for the Conservatives in the north. And for the NDP, even though the lead has narrowed from 10 points to 7 points, they're still ahead in seat-rich Metro Vancouver, ahead of the Conservatives in southern British Columbia, which used to be a stronghold for the Liberals, and also ahead in the island. The numbers for David Eby continue to be better on approval, on best premier, and also on some of the issues that we tested. So the battleground essentially is going to be figuring out a way for the Conservatives to make an emotional connection with voters. I think that's the thing that is missing right now. People are dissatisfied with the NDP. They found a vehicle in the Conservatives that they can latch onto in order to change the government. But we don't see the level of emotional connection that is required for a change when you ask people about their feelings towards John Rustad.
Yeah, what does John Rustad have to do to become the top choice? And is there any chance that Kevin Falcon could become the top choice at all, or is he a lost cause?
Well, it's definitely looking more dire with each passing month. I think, you know, they had what seemed to be a good run when they made the announcements related to childcare. Then they had to withdraw one of their candidates. It's been two steps forward, one step back. It's been very complicated for them to try to get some traction. And I think numbers like this are going to make it very difficult, particularly for incumbents who are going to be doing the barbecue circuit, to talk about why BC United has to be the choice. They think they can have a good run if they call into question some of the candidates from the BC Conservatives. But, you know, when you're essentially triple the support, which is what the Conservatives have right now, you no longer have the onus on yourself to say we should unite around Kevin Falcon because he's more experienced. So definitely a complicated scenario for the entire party, but particularly for those incumbent candidates who might not be having an easy time knocking on doors this year. For Rostad, I think, you know, one of the issues where he does a little bit better is the economy. And I think there's an opportunity to try to connect on the economic front. We know how much people are worried about inflation. We see housing as the number one issue facing the province. So if there's a way that they can connect with younger voters and middle-aged voters, it'll go a long way in you know, making this election a little bit closer than the last one. Part of that is also the leadership style. You know, we've seen Kevin Falcon not really being particularly likable. He has the lowest approval ratings. There's been a steady climb for John Rostad, but not at the level that they could actually get if he starts to establish that emotional connection with voters.
Now, Sonia Furstenow of the Greens, she's the longest serving party leader among the big four, having become the leader of the Greens in 2020, just before John Horgan's snap election. Now, she changed her mind and decided to run in the Beacon Hill riding, which is held by Grace Lohr, who is an NDP cabinet minister, and Tim Thielman from the Conservatives is also challenging for that riding. But just last week, we found out that Adam Olsen decided not to run again. He made the decision more than a month earlier, but he made it public that he is not going to run again. He wants to spend more time with his family, although he's going to have a hand in the campaign as a campaign chair. So that means the seat in Saanich North in the Islands is open. Do you think that Sonia Furstenow might have second thoughts about Beacon Hill and might insert herself on the ballot in the safe green riding in Saanich?
I think that would be the correct course of action in order to ensure that at least one of the seats remains with the Greens. It's a very difficult riding in Victoria Beacon Hill. It was Carol James's riding. You know, it hasn't gone to anybody else but the NDP since the 2005 election. So there's definitely a complexity in trying to start again. The Greens are, you know, trying to hammer some of the decisions made by the NDP, especially Sonia, by running against the cabinet minister. But your opportunities to actually keep the seat are going to be better if you run where Adam Olsen used to be the MLA, or I guess still is the MLA. It's really part of what happens in the Green Party. And I think we have a certain parallel when it comes to the federal Greens. You know, they spent several campaigns in the early years of the century running everywhere and trying to spend the same amount of money promoting candidates to get nowhere. It wasn't until Elizabeth May said, we're running in Saanich and we're going to try to win here and we're going to spend everything that we have to get me elected, that they did well. So I think it's a similar scenario right now for the Greens. Do you want to run a BC-wide campaign, try to run a full slate, try to help every single candidate and get into maybe the 16 or 17% level if you're lucky, or spend all of your resources ensuring that somebody can get elected in a place that has already elected Green? So I don't think it's out of the question, the notion that they might be thinking about abandoning the plan of running in Victoria Beacon Hill for their leader.
Now, the issues, the top three issues have really remained the same. You know, housing, homelessness, poverty, healthcare, and economy and jobs. The rest of the issues are in single digits. So you got only three mainstays in double digits. Are these set in stone? Could there be any change on the way to election day and there be a sleeper issue that that might make a difference here? Or is this what the parties are locking in for their messaging?
I think there's a couple of things that could move the needle a little bit. You know, housing has been top of the charts for the past couple of years. It's usually at around 20-something, 30-something. Now it's at 40% for the second consecutive month. So it's definitely an issue that is affecting more people. If we go back to the election of 2020, it was mostly millennials upset because they couldn't get in the market. and people in Metro Vancouver. But now it's the number one issue all across the province. So it's going to be tough to dislodge that. But one thing that tends to happen in the latter stages of campaigns is the issues of the day tend to play a role in the way people feel about things. And we saw something like that in 2009 when crime became an issue. And it was at 17% a month before the election of 2009. And then, you know, all of the parties start to scramble and start to think about some of their public safety policies. I think this would be beneficial for the Conservatives and for BC United, which have been very critical of the way things are going under the NDP. But it's really ultimately about trying to connect on the housing file. And it's a complicated issue. There's going to be a lot of promises. It's a significantly small runway for the NDP to try to get something done and to cut some ribbons. It's mostly going to be dealing with regulatory frameworks, which are not going to be easy to sell as a slogan. But on the other hand, the opposition parties have an opportunity to say, this is what we would do differently. And if that helps seal some of that 18 to 34 vote that is going to the Conservatives at a significantly higher rate than in other years, it could certainly make the election closer.
Now, what about the effects federally on provincial? Now, the BC Conservatives, as we know, are not affiliated with the federal Conservatives like the NDP is with its federal parent party. They share the same name, Conservative, but they're not one and the same. However, they share a lot of the same policies and some of the same people even. Now, John Rustad has done whatever he can to connect himself with Pierre Poilievre. The other side of the coin is the BC NDP, who are the party that Justin Trudeau likes the most in BC, but we're seeing some signs, perhaps, that David Eby is looking at the federal polls and the unpopularity of Justin Trudeau and distancing himself from Trudeau, from the federal Liberals. He's got a new message that it really is an us versus them message, that Ontario and Quebec are getting too much taxpayers' money from BC through the equalization program, that BC taxpayers' money is heading over there to Ontario and Quebec when it's needed here for so many reasons, especially since there's still the boom in immigration. There's needs in healthcare and transportation and education, but money is leaving BC and going to Ontario and Quebec, and David Eby's pointing that out quite aggressively. Do you think that he's going to move even further away from Justin Trudeau because it's almost toxic?
I think it's an opportunity to try to reconnect with voters who are no longer looking for that sort of symbiotic relationship like the one Justin Trudeau had with John Horgan. I mean, we remember those moments during the pandemic. You know, they were very popular. People were happy with their management of the pandemic. And it's a completely different situation now because Trudeau's numbers are nowhere close to where they used to be. And I think that is part of the exercise that the NDP campaign has to make on a local level. You know, there are certain aspects here that are going to be making people upset. And, you know, if you're worried about housing, part of it has to do with housing starts. Maybe we should talk a little bit more about immigration. It's not a responsibility of the BC government, of course, but it allows them an opportunity to say we're not being treated fairly by Ottawa. And now that you know that Trudeau is no longer as popular as he used to be, it certainly helps pave the way for people to say, well, at least, you know, he might be more of a center-left premier, but at least he's fighting for BC, and this is something that I will take into account when I'm making my choices in the election. The situation with the federal Conservatives is quite astonishing because the level of support that we're seeing for them in BC is closer to 50%. Stephen Harper formed three governments, one of them a majority government, and never got that type of support in British Columbia. We have to go back to the election of 2000 with Stockwell Day and the Canadian Alliance to find that type of support for a party at the federal level in BC. And it's an interesting situation because it's almost as if people are choosing who to be upset with. And they're looking at Justin Trudeau as the person who is responsible for most of the things that they're bothered by, and not necessarily David Eby. So I think there's an opportunity there for Eby to say, I'm going to distance myself from the way in which Ottawa has been doing things. I'm going to say a couple of things that make it look like I'm somebody who's not particularly happy with the status quo. And if it starts to resonate, I think they will do it more. But, you know, this is, like you say, it's a little test. You know, maybe this is something that people won't care about in the next couple of months. But if it happens, it's something that has been done before. I mean, we remember Christy Clark complaining at some of the premier's meetings because we had too many seniors and we weren't getting enough money from Ottawa. So it's a strategy that works for incumbents.
Are you seeing any differences in Surrey? Surrey is going to be a battleground. There's 10 ridings, 10 seats up for grabs there. The NDP holds a majority of ridings in the current configuration. But of course, this election will feature 93 seats up for grabs around the province, six more than the past. There's going to be 72 ridings with new boundaries drawn on the map. But Surrey is really the battleground. There's 10 there in such a small area, small relative area. What are you seeing from respondents in Surrey? Are they thinking or doing differently from British Columbians elsewhere?
What I see in Surrey is interesting in the sense of how it plays into the way in which we used to look at things in previous electoral contests. You know, it was always a contest between the Liberals and the NDP. The fact that Eleanor Sturco said, I can't win as a BC United candidate and I'm going to go to the Conservatives, certainly suggests that, you know, people around her are saying, you know, this isn't in the cards. You know, we would like to vote for you, but if you're going to be representing BC United, this isn't going to work. I think one thing that could help the government is that finally everything related to the police situation has been solved, maybe not to the full satisfaction of all the interested parties, but it's not going to be an issue that is going to creep in back into the electoral campaign. So making sure that that's out of the way 6 months earlier certainly helps the NDP. But it's also about how you can actually turn the Conservatives into some sort of juggernaut. You know, Linda Hebner is a phenomenal candidate for the Conservatives, somebody who actually ran the government in a city and whose experience in policy is certainly superior to most of the Conservative candidates who have said that they want to run for the party. So that really shows that there's an opportunity for the Conservatives to win and that the rules of engagement that we had in the elections of the past, which is we have one or two very popular BC Liberal incumbents who won't lose even if the government changes hands, are now no longer applicable.
Yeah, we're now in the thick of barbecue and festival and parade season around the province where politicians will get out there and shake hands and kiss babies. Do you think that there will be much movement at all in public sentiment between now and Labor Day, or are we going to need to wait until Labor Day and onward to gauge the sentiment of the public again? Will the public really care? And will those who are undecided really care until the debates happen, for instance, in September and October?
Well, there's a couple of things that can help. You know, you're not going to have a significantly active David Eby in the next few weeks because of the situation that he has at home. It's an opportunity for the opposition to connect. And I think something that will tell us more about how the situation is unfolding is going to be either seeing more people defecting or choosing not to be candidates or having the momentum on the candidate announcement stall. If we continue to have 10, 15, 20 seats where the BC United Party cannot find people to run, that is going to tell us something. The other thing that is crucial is the fundraising numbers, which we'll know probably by the second or third week of July. If we have a significant difference between the Conservatives and BC United, it's definitely going to throw a lot of heat into what's going to happen with BC United over the next 4 or 5 months. Because, you know, one of the things that they had an advantage on just a few months ago was they were raising more money. But if now the Conservatives are getting a lot of those donations at a higher rate than what BC United is getting, it seriously calls into question their viability as a political option, not only for voters, but ultimately their very existence.
Well, look forward to watching things progress over the summer. And then, of course, the race to the finish after Labor Day towards the October 19th election here in British Columbia. Right now, it's 16 weeks away. Right now, it looks like David Eby has the lead and could form another government, but stranger things have happened on the way to the election booth, voting booth. Thanks again to Mario Canseco, president of Research Co. talking about his latest poll on British Columbia politics, and look forward to having you back on the Breaker.News podcast.
Thank you.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, Edinburgh declines friendship deal with Kaohsiung over Beijing fears. Chinese diplomats reportedly displeased about proposed city-to-city agreement. Scotland's capital city planned to establish a friendship deal with Kaohsiung, but concerns from Edinburgh's business community and other sectors about a potential backlash from Beijing have forced the plan to be put on hold, reported the Financial Times on June 24th. Kaohsiung city government on June 25th said it would continue to interact with cities that share democratic values to expand urban diplomacy. In Kyoto news, motorized suitcase rider referred to prosecutors for first time. A Chinese woman became the first person to be referred to prosecutors for unlicensed riding. The three-wheeled suitcase the woman used can travel at a maximum speed of 13 kilometers per hour, the police said, adding that in Japan, such vehicles are classified the same as mopeds, with engine displacements of 50 cc or less. In the Hong Kong Free Press, exhibitors at Hong Kong's annual book fair should obey national security laws, organizer says. Asked by reporters whether Hong Kong Trade Development Council has a list of banned titles that would be censored, Deputy Executive Director Sophia Chong did not respond directly, instead saying that exhibitors should comply with local laws. Founded in 1990, the annual book fair has seen censorship since the enactment of Beijing's national security law in 2020. In 2022, the Hong Kong Trade Development Council turned down applications from at least three independent booksellers. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In Willamette Week, Multnomah County to halt purchases of tents and tarps. The move comes after City Commissioner Rene Gonzalez asked the county chair to stop them. Gonzalez had slammed the county's plan to allocate money for tents, tarps, and syringes in its $4 billion budget for the coming fiscal year. Vega Peterson agreed, saying that she wanted more shelter beds for the homeless. In Crosscut, how Seattle Public Library's cyber attack impacts patrons, students, tutors, laptops, printers, audiobooks, all are affected by the district ransomware attack and could take months to return to normal. Over Memorial Day weekend, the Seattle Public Library system went offline due to a cybersecurity attack. Virtually all services, including checking in and out physical books and movies, access to library accounts and ebooks, use of the library computers and Wi-Fi, were unavailable. Toronto's public library was targeted last October. It took 4 months to recover. And in the Breaker.News, read stories such as inside the Ecom 911 server crash, missed email caused delayed reaction. And the Breaker.News obtains BC Play Stadium's 2026 World Cup contract. Read more at the Breaker.News. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, cause love will conquer hate. Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Canadians, all 41 million of you. Happy 157th birthday to the home and native land. As Stompin' Tom Connors said, it's Canada Day up Canada Way on the first day of July. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That is the sound of Gramophonic from Washington, D.C., with the Star Spangled Banner, recorded June 27th at the United States Consulate in Vancouver. Stay tuned for Gramophonic's rendition of O Canada. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 30th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 30th of June in 1886, the first transcontinental train left Montreal? CPR Engine 371 arrived in Port Moody, BC on the 4th of July. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News on Twitter, also known as X, for news as it happens. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.